But I hope if people want to know about things which are in the schedule I produced and don't actually appear in the lectures, I think I was overambitious, but do ask me about those things over lunch or breakfast or whatever, or things I skate over, ask me for more details. So what I'm going to do today is finish off the sort of basic introductory section, talking briefly about diffeomorphisms and then about the continuum limit. And then I'll go through regicalculus very quickly in two dimensions, a bit more detail in three dimensions, and then even more detail in four dimensions. At least that's the plan. So first of all, diffeomorphisms. In the continuum, there's a close relationship between the Bianchi identities and the existence of diffeomorphisms, but nobody has managed to make that explicit in regicalculus. And in fact, there isn't even real agreement about how to define diffeomorphisms in regicalculus. There are basically two ways of defining, or two suggested ways of defining. Obviously, we're going to be looking at changes of edge lengths, since those are the variables. And the first point of view says that diffeos are transformations of the edge lengths which leave the geometry invariant. And people who come from a relativity background would certainly choose this way of defining diffeos, and it's probably the favoured method of most people here. It's most obviously related to the continuum way of defining.
What does it mean to leave geometry?
Well, it means that if you calculate anything like curvature, then you still get the same answer. But in fact, that's a very restricted definition for a discrete space-time, because this means that diffeos exist only exactly in flat space.
So that would be coordinate transformations.
Yeah, right. Obviously, in flat space, you can move the vertices around, which will change all the edge lengths, but you still have the same zero curvature and so on. If you have a space that's almost flat, then you can have approximate diffeos. And then the other idea is that we would take diffeos to be transformations of the edge lengths which leave the action invariant. And people who come from a particle physics background are much more used to transformations which leave actions invariant. And this is a much more flexible definition, because you can imagine changing the edge lengths in one region to decrease the Euler curvature and then increasing them in another region, and the things would balance out. Or you can even imagine doing some local transformation, changing some edges meeting at a vertex in a particular way and then changing other edges there to compensate. With this definition, then you can actually construct exact diffeos in three dimensions. You can use the fact that the star of a vertex, which I defined yesterday, in three dimensions, the star of a vertex can be uniquely embedded in flat four-dimensional space. There's a counting argument which shows you that the number of degrees of freedom that you have in the edge lengths is exactly equal to the number of coordinates you have to embed in four-dimensional space. So,
So I gather that then the range action is not like the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is zero in all vacuum solutions.
No, it doesn't have to be. So you, if you embed this three-dimensional vertex in a four-dimensional flat space, then you can have diffeos where you move the vertex around in the four-dimensional flat space in which it's embedded, and that will leave the action invariant. But it's not possible to generalize that to four dimensions because there isn't a unique way to embed a four-dimensional star in a five-dimensional flat space. I'll just mention conformal transformations extremely briefly. The obvious idea is to define conformal transformations at vertices. So you might define phi I at that vertex and phi j at that vertex, and then Lij, the length between those vertices, would go to phi I, phi j times Lij, or the geometric mean, or the sum, or whatever. But there's a problem with that in that we always want the triangle inequalities to be satisfied for, and their higher dimensional analogs to be satisfied. And it can be shown that you could have two of these transformations which individually preserve the triangle inequalities, but a product of them doesn't. So in fact, this only really works for infinitesimal transformations, and then the group property is preserved. So nobody has produced a way of writing down conformal transformations in Regi calculus in the general case. Now a little bit about how Regi calculus is related to the continuum. That's an obvious question to ask, how it's related to continuum general relativity. And the probably the most important work on this was done quite a long time ago by Cheeger, Muller, and Schrader. And the first two of those are mathematicians. Schrader's a physicist. And they looked at the analogues of some sort of curvatures that are defined in the continuum, something called Lipschitz killing curvatures. So they defined a piecewise linear space analog. And they showed that the Regi action in particular converges to the continuum action. Not locally, but in the sense of measures, so if you integrate over some region. And there is a condition. And the condition is on what's called the fatness of the simplices. It's not that you want the simplices not to be too fat, you don't want them to be too thin. So provided the simplices are fat enough. So that one means you don't want simplices which are very elongated and spiky. So this is a technical condition which I don't want to go into now. Yeah?
What's the parameter for the
oh, this convergence thing, it's the sort of lattice spacing type thing. Yes, the lengths. Yeah. Now, even if the actions are related, it doesn't related in this way, it doesn't necessarily mean that the solutions will be related in that way, because the variation that you do is slightly different. But John Barrett looked at that problem and showed that in a particular case, in the case of linearized regicalculus, where you assume all the deficit angles are small, then the under certain conditions, then the solutions of the linearized Regi equations converge to solutions of the linearized Einstein equations. Right, now I'll go on to what I was hoping to do in lecture two. So this is regicalculus in 2 and 3 dimensions. And first of all, 2 dimensions. Well, the Regi action in 2 dimensions, which is proportional to the sum of the deficit angles at vertices. Here we're defining the volume of a vertex, the volume of a point, to be 1. This is actually a topological invariant. This is equal to the Euler character divided by a constant, which is 4g. So that makes it sound as though regicalculus in 2 dimensions is very trivial. Obviously, if you just use that in the action, then it is pretty trivial. But what people have done is to include a cosmological constant term or even a curvature squared term. So the sort of action that has been written down and used in simulations in 2 dimensions could be something like sum over hinges, which are just the vertices. I won't bother to write the constant. And then you could have a cosmological constant times sum of areas. Wait a minute. This would be the total area there then. sorry, I'll explain what I mean by AI. Then another constant times the deficit angle, and another constant times deficit angle squared over AI. What I've done here is to define AI to be the area associated with a particular vertex. And there are various ways of doing that. The standard way is by the so-called Voronoi construction. And if you've got a single triangle, the idea would be to divide it up into points which are nearest to each of the vertices. So what you do is just draw the perpendicular bisector of each side and see where they meet. And then you would associate this region here with this vertex, this region here with that vertex, this with this, and then sum over all the other triangles at those vertices to get these AIs here. This term here is meant to be a curvature squared term, and I'll say a bit more about where we get that from when I talk about 4 dimensions. So this has been used in simulations in 2 dimensions. I think we really don't understand what's happening there, in that the results of the regicalculus simulations usually seem to agree with the flat space results, whereas the dynamical triangulations results seem to agree with the continuum theory. So there's obviously something strange there. Now, 3 dimensions. Now, we know that general relativity is pretty simple in three dimensions. And let's see what happens to Regi calculus. If we've got pure gravity, empty space, the action's just going to be either sum over edges. The edges are the hinges in this case. So we'll get length of edge times deficit angle there. And if you vary with respect to an edge length there, then you can see you're going to get a pretty simple result. It's the length of the ith edge. So, variation with respect to Lj implies epsilon j is naught. So we have flat space. There may be some topological degrees of freedom if the
edges or
well, it depends what dimension you're in. If you're in two dimensions, the epsilons are defined at the vertices. If you're in three dimensions, the epsilons are at the edges. Now let's include a matter contribution and see what difference that makes. So we'll go to the pure gravity term and then some matter term, and we'll suppose that the matter consists of particles with mass mi moving along some subset of the edges. Then what we have is for the matter term, we just get minus Li times Mi. So this won't in general include all of the edges. This will include some subset of edges. And then if we vary with respect to Lj again, we'll get this epsilon j, the deficit angle at the jth edge, is going to be naught for a hinge without a particle, hinge or edge. And it will be equal to 8 pi g times mi for a hinge with particle of mass mi. So the picture we get here, and I obviously just draw something that looks two-dimensional, but you have to imagine that these are all tetrahedra. The eyes are the edges, and the particles are on the edges.
So,
sorry, it should be J, not I.
So, okay, so you're two different.
Yep, sorry. So we have this sort of picture, and you imagine that on some edges there'll be some particles moving. So we have a picture like that, where some edges have got particles and some don't. In fact, they'll have to be moving along time-like edges. If we had particles moving on space-like edges, that would correspond to tachyons. Now let's go back to the Bianchi identities in three dimensions. And we'll see that they play a special role here. So we've got the product over the edges, I meeting at some particular vertex, some chosen vertex. Of exponential epsilon I times ui. The product of those rotation matrices, this is the rotation generator at the ith edge, the product of those exponentials will be equal to 1. And so rotation generator for edge I ui mu nu is 1 over the edge length epsilon mu nu rho times li rho. So this is orthogonal to the edge length, bivector orthogonal to the edge length. And what we're going to do now is apply the Bianchi identities to two particular scenarios to see what they actually give us physically. Well, in the first scenario, let's assume that we've got a single particle moving through this tetrahedral space-time. Let's suppose the particle goes along this edge here and then along this edge here. I'll assume this is edge L1 with deficit angle epsilon 1. This is L2 with deficit angle epsilon 2. P O Q. And we'll assume that the deficit angles at all the other edges are 0. Let's also assume that the first particle, the particle here, assume particle on PO is at rest, and it has mass big M. Well, if we set up local coordinates in this tetrahedral space-time and work out what we get here, then what we're going to have to use is that exponential of epsilon 1 U1 times exponential of epsilon 2 U2 is just the identity operator. If you take the trace of that equation, that immediately gives us what we want to know. It tells us that the two deficit angles are the same and that the speed of the second particle is 0. So what this is saying is that if you have a particle of mass m at rest, so this would have to be a purely an edge in the time direction, then that particle will continue to be at rest and it will still have the same mass. So we've obviously got conservation of momentum for a single particle. And then in a slightly more complicated setup, we look at the case where we have two incoming particles and they coalesce to form a third particle. So let me just draw a very simple diagram here. Let's suppose we've got particles going like that, and they coalesce to form a particle here. Call that particle 3, 1, 2, and 3. Let's suppose particle 1 has mass m1 and it's at rest. Particle 2 has mass m2 and it's moving with speed v2. And particle 3 has a mass m3 and speed v3. Then if you apply the Bianchi identities, so the product of the epsilons times rotation matrices exponentiated at all these edges, the product has to be equal to 1. What's the Bianchi identities? What you get out of that is the usual relativistic collision formulae. Which are calculated using conservation of three momentum and conservation of energy. So we see again that the Bianchi identities are in three dimensions are just equivalent to conservation. Well, I'm not sure whether the implication goes both ways, but certainly this way we have conservation of momentum in three dimensions. So when I've been talking about three dimensions here, I'm actually talking about 2 + 1 dimensions because I'm assuming that we've got real particles moving in space-time. I was hoping to talk a bit about the approach of Toff to 2 + 1 gravity, his polygonal approach. Yeah?
How do you establish if this is 2 + 1 instead of 3 + 0? Do some edges have negative length?
Oh, yes, some edges would have. I mean, you could have edges with zero length and some with negative length squared. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. The idea here was that Toft took spatial hypersurfaces, two-dimensional spatial hypersurfaces, and tessellated them with polygons, and then formulated various rules for the evolution of the polygons in time. And he produced a big crunch and a big crunch and big bang hypothesis, which basically said that if all of his polygons were contracting at a particular moment of time, then they would continue to contract and the thing would have a big crunch, and then the time reversal of that as well. And there are certain formulae in his approach which look very much like formulae in regicalculus. And so I and other collaborators spent quite a lot of time trying to understand the relation between these. And I think, I mean, probably we haven't understood all of it, but I think maybe the fact that the formulae look similar is because both of them are a reflection of the underlying hyperbolic geometry rather than any particular relation between the approaches. If anybody's interested in this, I can give some references. Another aspect which I would have liked to have time to talk about is whether there's a 3 plus 1 version of regicalculus like the ADM formalism in the continuum. And various people have worked on that. In fact, Reggie, with a collaborator called Fernando Lund, looked at this and managed to write down an action which was appropriate if you have a homogeneous space. So what they were doing was taking all the simplices to be identical, and you didn't actually need a shift vector. It's quite difficult to incorporate a shift vector into this sort of regicalculus. So the sort of action that Reggie had, I'll just write that down, the Lund-Reggie action. So this is for homogeneous spaces. You have the time integral, and then there's a minus 1 over 4n, where the n is the lapse. That's taken to be uniform because it's a homogeneous space. Then you get the number of 4 simplices divided by the volume of 1, and then a sum over squared edge lengths with time derivatives taken, si dot sj dot d2v by d. Si, dsj, and then plus 2n times sigma li epsilon I. So this is basically the 3 curvature that you get in the ADM action. And then this part here corresponds to the trace of k squared minus the trace of k all squared. There was some clever way of getting from this to this.
What was S?
S is L squared, so SI is LI squared. so it's just more convenient to use a squared edge length here because this should be the volume squared here. It's easier. The natural way of expressing volumes is in terms of squared edge lengths rather than edge lengths. So that has this lapse function, but it has no shift. Various people have tried to include a shift vector, Friedman and Jack in particular, but it turned out to be quite complicated, and that's sort of been rather left on the side. So I won't say any more about that now. Now I'll get on to 4 dimensions. This is basically what I wanted to start with in this lecture. Now, after Ponzano and Reggie produced their model in 1968, as I said earlier, it was a long time before anybody did anything in 4 dimensions in the way of quantum regicalculus. And that was mainly because it was hard to see how their result could be extended to 4 dimensions. And also, it's quite difficult to do analytic work in 4 dimensions unless you've got something extremely symmetric. So that actually prompted people to look at perturbation theory rather than trying to do some general formulation. So I'll tell you about some work on perturbation, about some, the usual thing is to take it about some fixed back, some flat background. And although this is a particular calculation, the sort of techniques in it are used in other work on four-dimensional Reggie calculus too, so that's why I'm going to go into some detail. And the first calculation was trying to investigate the relationship between the propagator in Reggie calculus and the continuum propagator in the weak field limit. And that worked out all right. So what I'm going to do is consider an infinite space. This is actually all going to be Euclidean signature. So I'm taking R4, and we're going to consider a very symmetric tessellation of that. Take a lattice of unit hypercubes. And then we'll perturb the, we'll start with flat space edge lengths for everything. We'll divide the hypercubes into simplices, and then we'll perturb their edge lengths by small amounts. So let me tell you how we describe this. We'll suppose the vertices are labeled by n1, n2, n3, n4. So the n's are integers. And then each of these hypercubes is divided into 24 four simplices by drawing in appropriate diagonals. We only need to draw in the forward going diagonals to do this. Now, rather than trying to draw something in four dimensions, I'll draw the lower dimensional analogues and you'll see what the idea is. Well, in two dimensions, you would just start with a lattice of unit squares and label the vertices by 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, and so on. And then the diagonals that you have to draw in would just be these diagonals. So we divide all the squares into two-dimensional simplices, which are triangles. So we only have to draw in one diagonal per square there. In three dimensions, start with a unit cube, and then you draw in all the forward-going diagonals. Most of these are going to be on the face. And then there'll be one special one which goes from the base point here to the opposite vertex, like that. And you can see that in three dimensions you could generate this by If you just translate a vertex and three edges coming out of it, then you can generate that whole thing. Here, if you translate a vertex with three coordinate edges and then three diagonal edges and then the long diagonal like that, so there would be seven in that case, three here. And then in four dimensions, you generate something with 15 edges going out of it. So in each case, there are 2 to the n minus 1. Now, to make life easier, we actually interpret the coordinates of vertices neighbouring the origin as binary numbers. So, for example, the vertex 0, 1, 0, 0 would be 4, and 1, 1, 1, 1 would be vertex 15, and so on. And then the edges coming out from the origin, this is four dimensions now. There would be... the edges would go to vertices 1, 2, 4, and 8. Those would be in the coordinate directions. And then there'd be some face diagonals, which would go to vertices 3, 5, 6, 9, 10, 12. Call those face diagonals. And then there would be some 7, 11, 13, 14... all those body diagonals, those would go between opposite vertices of cubic faces. And then finally, the edge going to the opposite vertex, we call that the hyperbody diagonal. Now, you may wonder why I'm going into all this detail, but it's just easier to explain the results if I explain that notation. So we're now going to perturb about flat space. And so the edges will become things like upper index I, lower index j, will be Lj into 1 plus delta ij, where delta is small compared with 1, it might be negative or positive. The superscript I actually denotes the base point, so that's an edge going from point I, and then the subscript denotes the direction. And the unperturbed edge lengths so those would just be 1, root 2, root 3 or 2 depending what sort of edge you were looking at. So for example, if you had something like delta 1, 14, that would be the perturbation in the edge from vertex 1 in the 14 direction, and that actually means to vertex 15. So that's the sort of thing we're doing. And now we're going to work out the regi action. Yeah?
I was wondering why we were actually using the edges. Shouldn't our basic variables be hyperplanes? Because it shouldn't be of codimension 2. That's where the curvature lies.
Well, the edge lengths are still the variables. The curvature is at the triangles. That's right. So we will have to work out areas of triangles and deficit angles at triangles. I'll talk tomorrow about the situation where you use the areas as variables.
So it's not anymore remote coordinates, right?
No. Oh, it's just about edge lengths. So now we want to work out we're in four dimensions, so it's going to be sum over the triangles of area of a triangle times deficit angle. And we calculate this for the one at the origin, for the hypercube at the origin, and then get others by translation. Now, what you actually get here is something that's quadratic in these deltas for the following reason. So, we're taking these perturbed edge, perturbations of the edge lengths to be the variables, and we can say that, I mean, writing it schematically, so imagine a Taylor series. Now, flat space, the action for flat space is zero, so that term's not going to appear. And flat space is also a solution, and so the first variation of the action will also be zero. So the first non-zero contribution we'll get will be something that's quadratic in the deltas. And we'll write it as think of it as a quadratic form, so we can write it as the transpose of an infinite dimensional column vector times a matrix times an infinite dimensional column vector. So the entries in this infinite column vector will be all the delta i's at all the vertices. So this has got 15 components per point. Or per vertex in the lattice. And M is an infinite dimensional sparse matrix. Because the regi action only couples edges in neighbouring symplices, then most of the entries in this infinite dimensional matrix will be zero. We'll just get a band sort of down the diagonal, which won't be zero. It turns out that the entries corresponding to this hyperbody diagonal, those all disappear at this level, just keeping terms of second order in delta. So fluctuations
of hyper body diagonal R0 to this order. And so they don't appear at all in this sum. And so this means we have a one-parameter family of zero eigenmodes corresponding to these. There's also a four-parameter family of zero eigenmodes, which just correspond to fluctuations of the vertices in flat space. And those are actually the exact diffeomorphisms in that case. Sorry, I've written a bit too low there. Now, nobody likes to have to handle an infinite dimensional matrix, least of all me. So what we do there, we actually manage to block diagonalize it by Fourier transformation, or you can think of it as an expansion in periodic modes. So if we suppose we've got a delta...
Would that be a good... are you close to something?
Right. I was hoping to finish this, but maybe I shouldn't. Can I have 5 more minutes, or is that going to mess everything up? Right, I'll try. If we had the delta at... based at a point which has got coordinates A, B, C, D, then we say that that's omega 1 to the D, omega 2 to the C, omega 4 to the B, and omega 8 to the A times the corresponding delta based at the origin. These may look a funny way around, but it's all because it's this binary notation. And then when you do this, you actually get M becomes block diagonal with a 15 by 15 matrix M omega along the diagonal. And this M omega looks like the following thing. It's got a 10 by 10 block there. A 4 by 10 matrix there, 0, B transposed, 18 times the unit matrix, and then zeros everywhere else. And these A and B are both, their entries are functions of the omegas.
And then we can actually go further and block diagonalize that. And we get A10 minus 1/18 of B transposed. 18 times the unit matrix there, and zeros everywhere else. And the point about that is that this part here means that some of our deltas are really decoupled. The deltas corresponding to these positions in the matrix are actually constrained to vanish by their equations of motion. That actually implies the deltas with corresponding to 7, 11, 13, and 14 have decoupled, constrained to vanish. And we already got rid of the 15 one. So although we started with 15 variables per point, well, if you write down their equations of motion, then you can see they have to be zero. and now we've ended up with 15 minus 4 minus 1, so we've now got 10 variables per point, which looks like the continuum. And then what we showed was that the if you take the omegas, omega I is basically related to... it's an exponential involving momentum, so it's basically e to the minus I a ki, where that's momentum. Remember, it corresponds to a Fourier transformation. And if you expand all this in A and compare with the continuum expression in momentum space, then you get an exact correspondence. That's all I can say about it now, since I've run over time. So that's encouraging, but because it shows that at least at the weak field limit, what you get when you look at the propagator in four dimensions in Regi calculus agrees with the continuum expression. So I'll stop there. Yes.
I was confused as to the meaning of velocity in that context. Is it just a coordinate velocity?
Yes, we choose some coordinates, and it's just the velocity in those coordinates. Yeah.
Are they arbitrary coordinates?
Yeah, you can choose them how you like in each simplex. Yeah.
The correspondence is with the continuum in which gauge?
Well, you have to do some gauge fixing with the harmonic gauge, I think.
Yeah.